I'm Matthew Petty, and this is Intersection. If you own a restaurant or have a veggie garden, fall is a season of abundance. In Florida, the fall harvest includes vegetables like turnips, kale, squash, and okra. To see what Central Florida has to offer, we're taking a ride to Thomas and Family Farm in Samsula, Volusia County. The farm's off a dirt road about 20 minutes' drive from DeLand.
So here we are on Cucumber Lane. Cucumber Lane leads us to Thomas and Farm.
That's Hari Pulapaka, executive chef and co-owner of Crest Restaurant.
So I make this trip as often as I can. I make also the trip to DeLeon Springs as often as I can. As you can see, it's very therapeutic and quieting a little bit. It's different from Interstate 4.
We pull up in front of a metal-sided barn.
Here we are. That's Paul probably hosing down. That's Paul. Bill. It could be Bill, actually. That's the father. We're lucky we're going to have a chat with Bill and Paul. And you'll also meet the farm dog, Miley. He's very friendly. So we're going to get, you know, obviously what's growing right now. We're going to get some eggplant, basil, turnips that are just early in the season, and some yellow and green squash. So what I'm thinking of making is, I was a vegetarian in India for 21 years. My wife's a vegetarian now. So I'm always very sensitive to making dishes that are vegetarian but are also full-flavored, and the guest doesn't feel like they got cheated out just because it was a vegetarian dish. So just as I'm standing here, I'm thinking of a basic, simple, hearty, comforting rice dish with all of those things that we're just going to get. So we make sort of a rice pilaf with turnips and eggplant and squash and Indian flavors, ginger, garlic, some chilies, some curry leaves, what have you. We make a simple rice pilaf. And that can be an accompaniment for a chicken dish or roasted mushroom or what have you.
Inside the barn, Bill Thomason and his son Paul unload turnips from a trailer and wash them in a big tub. They pack the turnips into plastic pallets and stack them in a chiller. Bill Thomason tells me his dad built this barn in 1937, but it was his mother who taught him how to farm. She worked in the fields until she was 88. Bill Thomason is wearing a long-sleeve shirt, a big straw hat, shorts, and no shoes.
Because I haven't worn shoes to the farmer's market in probably 30 years, so everybody knows me as a barefoot farmer.
When did you decide to ditch the shoes?
Well, I used to load the trucks, and you load them early in the morning, and I'd have like tennis shoes on. They'd get wet, and they were just miserable to walk in. I always go barefoot in the field, so I just decided to just quit that with the tennis shoes and go barefoot.
Do you feel like you kind of learned something about the land you're farming on from walking around it and feeling it under your feet?
Oh, yeah, it's very difficult to farm, especially in this area and especially in Florida, with wearing any kind of shoes or boots, because you let it rain and the mud weights your feet down, it'll just tire you out so bad. And it's easy to wash these boots off.
So tell me about your farm. What do you got going on here?
Well, we grow about 70 different crops over the course of the year, about 50 crops during the winter. We farm all year long. And the biggest thing we have to contend with is the weather, and that's every day. You don't know, you know, from day to day, you say you're going to do this or do that, and you hear the weather report 3 days before, and then it changes the next day and changes the next day, and then you go out that morning and you say, well, I can't do anything I said I was going to do because this is all wrong. The weather changes so fast here. Like yesterday, 20% chance of rain. It rained here most of the day. The hardest thing is about farming is have to contend with nature, and then if you're sick or whatever, it doesn't matter. You got to go out in the field and work anyway because there's nobody else out there to do it. Because we don't really hardly anybody, so we just do it all ourselves. So you have to just go out and work. It's a lot of work every day.
How big is your farm?
We get up to about 10 acres planted at one time.
Who do you sell to? Is it mainly restaurateurs?
A lot of restaurants. We got a lot of local restaurants, including Hari.
That's one of the original.
Yeah.
We go back a few years.
Yeah. But then we have a lady that delivers restaurants all the way down to Miami. Then we go to four markets a week. One was Florida Hospital. Now we just go to three markets a week, farmers markets.
Is there more interest now when people coming and seeing where the food is from?
I know everybody's fascinating because there's hardly any farms left around here like this. I mean, the kind of farming we do with that many crops, and people come out here and see this, and they're just amazed at it. And I'm sure it's really interesting for them because, you know, for us, I've been my whole life doing this, but for them to be able to come out and actually see a farm, like on the Volusia County Farm Tour, we're about the only actual farmer because the rest of them, you know, they might have so many animals or, you know, some alpacas or whatever they are, and then they might have chickens, they might have this and that, but actually full-time business farming on actually a small scale, we're about the only one that's actual farm on the Volusia County Farm Tour. And people love it, and they see how we do everything, and I guess they're kind of amazed, and I guess we probably get customers from that, from all of that.
Is it the kind of business do you really have to be born into, do you think? Or are there a lot of young folks saying, I want to try that?
A lot of them say they want to try that, and then they find out it's so much work and they don't last long. It's just a lot of work. You have to really push yourself to get all the work done.
Paul Thomason, also shoeless, chimes in.
I mean, it's 7 days a week, and it's long 7 days a week, and it's grueling work, it's tiring work, it's, you know, often with the weather, it's frustrating work. And so for people to get into it these days is difficult. And there's a lot of new young farmers and stuff that are, you know, trying to become farmers. But unfortunately, you know, they're book smart, but they're not born into it. And so they go out there and they're practicing everything that they've been taught in the books. And there's a big disconnect between those, you know, the older farmers, which probably, I think the average farmer in the state of Florida is about 65, 66 years old. So you got a big disconnect 66. With all these new young people coming in to start farming, you know, and they just don't have the family. You know, I'm doing things because that's what my dad did, not necessarily because I learned it in the book. And so I think there is a little bit of a struggle to come in and start farming.
Did you want to be a farmer when you were growing up?
I wanted to be anything but a farmer, honestly. And then in 2010, you know, as my dad was just getting a little bit older, we just kind of made a family decision. Either our farm was going to be another one of the, you know, the 66 that used to be around here that are gone, or just, you know, the many across the country. And so just made a decision just that we were going to continue the farm, and I would move in here and start, you know, start farming. So.
Do you worry a little bit about the farm continuing, you know, once you decide to get out of farming, if you ever do?
Yeah, a little bit. You know, I've got four children myself, and I've got a couple boys who enjoy the farm and may want to continue to do it. And so I think there's a good possibility that we may continue the farm to another generation, especially with the demand, you know, just the demand for, you know, for local food, and, you know, just the tremendous amount of families that depend on us, you know, week in and week out, and local, you know, restaurants as well that depend on us. So I'm hoping and actually hopeful that we'll actually have another generation here for sure.
So it's tough work, but do you enjoy it? Do you like what you do?
I do enjoy it, yeah. The farm work is a lot of fun. Sometimes, you know, when you got pressure, you know, getting orders together, and the weather can make it stressful. But as far as just the work itself, when the weather's decent, farming's enjoyable. It's fun. It's busy, but there's a laid-back style to it as well.
A short walk from the barn, there's a pasture with rows of squash.
Yeah, this is yellow squash, you know, summer squash, and this is the to pick it. So I just go in, you know, by hand and just harvest it, and, you know, we just pick them off. On the zucchini, we use a little knife, a little potato knife that we've transformed into what we, you know, what we call a zucchini knife. And this is going to, some of this is going to farmers markets, and then probably about half of it's going to end up going to some restaurants and some other businesses that run, you know, some stores, some vegetable stores and stuff, farm stores.
How long is the harvest season for this?
We start planting the yellow squash, all the squashes, all the cucumbers, squashes, eggplants, basil, all those type of things, all the okra. We start planting that mid-February. It starts coming in towards the end of April, and it'll pick. And then we replant all these crops, with exception of the okra. We plant them every 3 weeks, and then those usually will last about into mid to late November. Once we get the first frost and stuff, they'll start to taper off. Right now, we pick all our squashes and cucumbers, okras, everything every other day. When we get to, you know, really actually about right now, the sun's dropped, and so we start picking about every 3 days. And then when we get into, like, you know, towards mid November, it'll be every 4 or 5 days we'll come out and pick it. It's just not producing enough because the sun's lower in the sky, and then also because the you know, temperatures just dropped. So.
You talk about folks who maybe have never seen a farm before. Are there people out there like, what is this and what do I do with it?
Your standard variety, like leaf lettuces, the okras, you know, maybe just the purple eggplant. Most people know what those kind of things are. You know, broccoli, you know, the white cauliflower, orange carrots. But when you start getting into, you know, like rainbow carrots and four different color beets and five different color cauliflowers and things like kohlrabi and daikon radishes, some of those things people have never seen before. So we do get a lot of people coming to the farmer's market like, what is this? Where did this come from? What family is this in? And so we probably, most of the conversation at the farmer's market is really educating people on the crops that we're selling and, you know, where they come from, obviously, but also, too, how to cook them. Especially, like, you know, when you come down towards the end of, you know, lettuce season. Lettuce usually ends for us in, like, May, June. So we have the whole summer no lettuces. So people come out and they say, oh, no lettuce, we'll have to go to Publix. And I always say, no, you don't have to go to Publix. You can make a cucumber salad, or you can make a basil arugula salad with some cucumbers in it. There's a whole lot of things you can do. And so I do that a lot, trying to get people to transition from what they thought they came to the farmer's market for, but what they can get locally and fresh and eat that instead.
An ATV right away, there's a paddock full of lettuce seedlings, rows and rows of tiny green shoots.
Obviously, you couldn't have this many heads of lettuce in one area. So when these plants get about this tall, we'll just come in here and we'll just pull all these up, put them in a box, and then we take them and then we transplant them and stuff.
Do you do that by hand?
We pull them by hand, yeah.
Yeah.
Pull them by hand. Yeah, in fact, we do, all our harvesting out here is done by hand, every single bit of it. Like when we go to the farmer's markets and stuff, I tell everybody, there's a 50% chance that I harvested every, you know, this bunch here you're buying or this one because it's my dad and I.
And in the next field, okra. Paul Thomason snaps off a couple of the vegetables and munches on them, explaining how Campbell's Soup developed this hybrid in the 50s, trying to find a less slimy version of okra.
They cross-pollinated a couple different types of okra, Louisiana White Velvet and the Clemson, and they come up with this, and it's called Emerald. You don't see it in the grocery stores a lot because it doesn't ship well. It doesn't last as long as the Clemson, but it can get 18 inches long, still be tender, it's less slimy, and it's a fantastic. We used to grow both kinds and sell them both kind of side by side at the farmer's market, and over about a two-year period, people just completely quit buying the Clemson and started buying Emerald. So this is what we grow, and I actually have never seen anybody else growing it in my entire life.
What do you got down here? Are these onions?
These are multiplier onions. This is an interesting crop, too. A gentleman gave my grandmother a pile of these, probably about a, you know, I don't know, maybe 200 or 300 plants, back about 20 years ago. And you take these things and you plant them individually and just down your row, and they, each single onion will multiply into about 30 or 40 onions. And so for the last 20 years, we have never bought an onion seed. We just continue to, we plant them singular, let them grow, and they get multiplied. We farm them, we harvest them for the restaurants and for the orders for the farmer's market. And then when we get down towards the end of a patch, we take a bunch of the other ones and we just transplant them in new ground and continue to grow them.
Wow. Because you could say it's an heirloom crop.
Yeah, it's exactly. It's an heirloom crop, and it never needs seeds, never needs anything. These things will just continue to multiply and grow. I assume that, you know, my entire life I'll farm and grow these things, and I'll never have to buy a seed for them. Mm-hmm. So, and we actually have several crops that we do harvest the seeds. You know, a lot of the pumpkins, some of the harder squashes, we harvest a lot of the seeds on those. Not so much because it's easy, but just because with the pumpkins and stuff, we just want to make sure we're kind of keeping our strands that we have and that work real well for us. And so we just don't buy pumpkin seed. We just dry them out and continue to use them. So.
Then it's back to the barn where Hari loads a tray of vegetables into his car, bound for the restaurant.
I already got the basil.
You want to grab whatever eggplants you want?
And one bunch of red Russian kale. Like 2 bunches of red Russian.
If you want to take out, let's put 5 pounds.
We're not putting this in.
You just put it right in there. I'll grab a couple. Two turnips, two red Russian.
And
squash.
5 pound squash, and I'm taking the eggplant.
You're listening to Intersection on 90.7 News. I'm Matthew Petty. Up next, farm-to-table cooking. And can you tell where produce comes from by the way it tastes? Intersection continues in a minute. Welcome back to Intersection on 90.7 News. I'm Matthew Petty. In the kitchen of Crest Restaurant in DeLand, with a big metal extraction fan whooshing away, Chef Hari Pulaparker is washing vegetables picked from the farm.
You know how you tell the produce is local? Is when it's sandy. And you know how you tell when produce is local and someone hasn't been doing it for a while? It's sandy. It may look like it's washed, but you really gotta wash it. I mean, there's fine particulate sand everywhere. So when I eat in restaurants, and if I taste sand in my food, I know that the produce is probably local. But I also know that somebody didn't take the time to wash it better. Commercially bought, large-scale farming produce is really well washed. There's no sand. It always says on the label, triple washed, ready to use. So it's a little simple giveaway in restaurants.
So it could be a good thing, though, if you find some sand,
it's
right?
It's a good thing. I don't ever complain. I just chuckle that somebody didn't taste it before they served it.
So what are you washing right here?
So I'm washing some of the vegetables we got at Paul and Bill's farm. Some eggplant, 2 varieties of eggplant. I don't think there's a difference in this preparation. I'm just going to make a simple rice pilaf. And then I've got what's called a sunburst squash. It's the way it looks. It's a green squash, sunburst squash. Classic yellow crookneck squash. And some turnips, just early season turnips. And we'll have these all the way through the middle of winter, towards the end of winter even. We'll have this all the way through March.
That turnip you're holding is about the size of, I don't know, a billiard ball?
Yeah, exactly. And you can eat it raw. These are delicious. A bit of sea salt on it, straight up. It's better than a carrot.
I noticed that the Thomasons were kind of snacking on the veggies as they picked them.
They are, because I think they're hungry, but they're also probably doing some quality control. My guess is if there's something that stands out as being bitter, or like they don't want to bring a whole batch of eggplant to the market when every one of those is really bitter. I don't think they're eating the squash to say, I need my squash today. So before I get too far in, I got to prepare my vegetables a little bit. This is rice pilaf, so I'm not going to obsess over it. Just a little onion sliced up. I'm just building some flavor in the pan right now. This is a Scotch bonnet pepper that a lady brings in locally for us. Scotch bonnet is related to the habanero, very typical of West Indian cuisine, as you know. I like a little spice in my food. I suspect you don't mind it either. We could have more, but just one just to make it interesting. And then a little bit of fresh ginger. You notice I always create a flat surface so that things don't slide around on the board. Cut aside and then lay it on its side, and then I can go faster. Otherwise, round things tend to roll, and that's when cuts happen.
Have you ever injured yourself cooking?
Oh, yes, many times. Many times. This particular finger is a little bit smaller than it used to be. That tip, at least, anyway. So part of cooking for us is, sounds are important. I can hear that onion. I know what's happening. I don't have to be facing it at all times, because that's a waste of time. I need to be able to do other things and hear sounds and smell things, and I have to know when it's time to turn to address something or look at it. And that's important. We want a little caramelization here. Just a little bit of brownie. People worry that they burn food. It's very hard to burn food. You can brown food very easily when they have a lot of natural sugar content like onions do. But you want that. I mean, without that, you're going to be dying to get good flavor. You want that caramelization always. Always the thing, our heat is always very high. Essentially, I'm just layering the flavors, and at some point, this rice is basmati rice. I'm just soaking it. I washed it 3 or 4 times. I'm soaking it to draw out the excess starch so that the rice pilaf stays more separate. If I didn't wash the rice, it's perfectly good. In fact, you lose some nutritional value when you wash rice, but it gets more starchy and gets more gooey. Now, ideally, I should have all of this prepped ahead of time. Everything's cut, ready to go. But just in the interest of time, I'm trying to time what I'm putting in as I'm cutting it. So not too big, not too small.
And what are you cutting right here?
This is the eggplant, one of the eggplants that we got. This is the typical Italian eggplant, if you will. And this is the purple eggplant over here. And in true form, I got to sneak in some Indian flavors. So this is one. Ground turmeric, some ground coriander, which is the cilantro plant, the seed of the cilantro, and then ground cumin powder.
So I notice you've got, rather than sticking a lid on it, you've got a piece of foil and you've just kind of crimped the edges of it.
Yeah, we don't have any lids in this restaurant. Unless it's a dish like this that needs steaming, we exaggerate flavor in dishes by evaporation. Risotto is a classic example of that. So that's intentional, that we don't have lids. We can afford to buy lids, we just don't want to ever use them because we want to have intense flavor in the dish by concentration. So this is going to do its thing. The rice will be done in about 10 minutes and hopefully the dish will be done.
Waiting for the rice to cook, Hari sits at the bar of his 25-seat restaurant and talks about what farm-to-table dining means to him.
So farm-to-table is a very complicated phrase, believe it or not. To me, farm-to-table means that I have a sense of knowing where some of the ingredients are from. I know the farm. I know something about their practices. I know something about the families that perhaps have an investment in that farm. So one could make the argument everything is pretty much farm to table. You know, very few things in life are not from a farm of some sort in terms of food. But to me, it's not all farm to table. Farm to table has more to do with a knowledge and appreciation, evaluation of the ingredients, an investment in the origin of the ingredients, and then ultimately to be able to handle those ingredients appropriately, be able to showcase them and take a pride in what somebody else took a pride in to bring it to you in the first place. So as a chef, I'm always inspired by ingredients, and so I don't just want the ingredient, I want to know the story behind the ingredient as much as I can.
we went out to this farm where you saw some of your produce from. You picked some squash, some other vegetables, and that's now simmering away on the stove. Is that typically the way it works? You kind of go from basically from the dirt to the plate, just like that?
You know, in my ideal world, it would all go that way. But, you know, we live in a town that's away from certain ingredients that we need. So sometimes our ingredients come in a box like other people's ingredients do. But when it's possible, I'd like to have a conversation, not necessarily literally, but figuratively, with the person who had something to do with raising that or growing that. So in this instance, when it's this time of year in Florida, the fall, you know, produce is abundant. It's a wonderful time to go to the farms nearby, and we have got quite the plethora of delicious seasonal ingredients growing in our backyard. So yes, in this instance, from here on until April, we'll be doing a lot of this dirt to plate.
What about the kind of popularity of the farm to table movement? Is it something that maybe more chefs are trying to get into now than they might have in the past?
So the popularity of farm to table is absolutely at an all-time high. I do think more and more chefs are embracing the idea. They're embracing it in different ways and for different reasons than perhaps I am, and that's not important. What's important is that they're supporting those small farms and backyard farms that really, back in the day, used to sustain our plate, if you will, our dinner plate. We have a few farms in Volusia County, and there are two very specific ones that I've supported since the beginning of Crest, that I can't imagine them growing something that's delicious and fresh and it's not being used by our locals. So that to me is a travesty. So if more chefs out there are embracing the idea and they're taking the time to find out what's growing in their areas, there'll be less and less of that. Produce that's growing locally and that's on a small scale, it's fresh and it's seasonal, sometimes generational, is being consumed by the region. That's the whole notion of terroir when it comes to wine, for example. You know, your food will start tasting like your region. There's no better compliment as a chef for me than to say the food is fresh and it tastes like where we're from.
Is there a terroir to Florida? Like, can you identify food from the flavor?
You know, it's interesting you say that. I mean, Florida is known for its citrus and Florida is known for its seafood. Having said that, it's sometimes frustrating to find a lack of good seafood in the state. That's changing a little bit. More and more chefs are embracing lesser species of fish. Florida is quite the melting pot. It has some distinctive produce and agricultural products. Seafood is a huge one. Citrus is a huge one. And then, of course, there are multiple other ones like celery and corn and okra and field peas and what have you, shellfish, of course. In fact, this reminds me of a conversation we had not too long ago in Central Florida of trying to define the flavor of our region, the flavor of our terroir. And then a bunch of us got together, and we drafted a document that we called the Chef's Manifesto. And in there, we tried to define, essentially, what is it that we're proud of? What is our terroir? What is the pride in our place? And we realized right away that it probably is stretching it to name just a few things. We are a bunch of things. But we do have to be conscious of what's growing here seasonally and at what time and what's being raised and what's being harvested, what kind of fish is running, what kind of shellfish is being harvested, what kind of fruits are growing, what kind of vegetables are growing, and then to maximize the utilization of that which comes from our state. And if we can do that systematically, we would be a much richer state than we already are.
Just getting back to the idea of the harvest, is now the best time to be eating out because of the abundance of food that you can get from Florida?
Absolutely. And so, for example, if you go to a restaurant today and you didn't get some version of a squash or some version of a kale or some version of a spinach or some version of fresh herbs, then they're not using the bounty of our time and our season, if you will. So yeah, it's a great time, not just because it's beautiful weather. It's also, you can, as you pointed out, taste the terroir of our farms. You're tasting that which is being harvested and then hopefully prepared thoughtfully by a professional for the enjoyment of the masses.
Are there enough of these farms to sustain restaurants like yours and others?
Easy answer for me. There are plenty of farms to sustain a restaurant like ours because we have a small restaurant. There aren't enough small farms out there to sustain the number of plates every day in the state of Florida. Whether it be a hotel, whether it be a convention center, whether it be a larger restaurant, whether it be a chain, what have you. We need to, at the very least, support the farms that already exist here. And as Paul Thomason pointed out this morning, if the farms that exist are lucrative and profitable, that will naturally inspire other farmers to come on board and embrace farming as a viable occupation like it used to be a few decades ago. And that's what's getting away from us. And I'm not the farmer, but I can appreciate the economics of it all, that it's hard work, it's year-round work, it's so susceptible to the elements, and the margins are fairly low. So why would somebody want to embrace farming as an occupation unless there's a reward for all of this? And so we have to support the farms that exist now, myself and the larger enterprises included, and that in turn we think, if the models hold and if common sense holds true, would naturally lead to a growth in the number of small farms in our region. We could use more small farms, I'm pretty sure.
Do you see this farm-to-table idea tailing off, or is it going to keep gathering momentum?
The notion hopefully will never taper off and will only get better and come back to our roots like we used to be. But the phrase itself is getting a bad rap, and in my opinion, sometimes rightfully so. Because like anything that's fashionable, folks are embracing it without really being invested in it. And that's naturally a compromise of the concept at its core. So when that happens, there's some skepticism that builds into the phrase, some doubt, some almost even aversion to the idea by others who say, well, what the heck, why should I pay more because somebody names themselves a farm-to-table restaurant? You don't really have to pay more, but you have to maybe be willing to understand that the food is seasonal and the ingredients are seasonal. You can't always expect your raspberry pie year-round. You know, sometimes it's a rhubarb pie, sometimes it's a sweet potato pie, sometimes it's a turnip pie, you know. So the idea of having the same ingredients year-round puts a lot of pressure on the marketplace, and that's when small farms are not able to be viable because they have ingredients that are natural for that time and place, but they're not able to find the market for it because people don't know how to use them, or B, are unwilling to use ingredients that are not part of some recipe.
What's your takeaway from the season? What do you like most about it, aside from the weather?
I love the fact that we can dine in a relaxed environment without the need for artificial air conditioning. We can open the doors. A lot of the times in the year, we're within closed doors. We're not able to enjoy the elements for what they are. You may be eating what's in season, but you're not necessarily feeling it in other ways. But now when you can sit outside and you can smell the air and you're comfortable and you can be with friends and you can enjoy a meal that was prepared using good ingredients that are in season from farms around us, that's the full circle. I mean, that's the full circle. People romanticize about going to Tuscany and Napa Valley and things like that because you're able to do that, more of that. So when we're able to do this here in our region, it's a tremendous time of year to be alive.
Then it's back to the kitchen to check on the rice pilaf.
Well, it smells great.
Oh, yeah. Why wouldn't it? Voila, the rice is cooked.
It's going to be hot, temperature hot.
Not bad, yeah? And this is fairly healthy. So turnips instead of potatoes.
That's better for you?
I don't know if it's better for you. It's certainly seasonal. It's fresher. And kale. And eggplant.
So there it is. Rice pilaf from farm to table with locally grown Volusia County vegetables. You're listening to Intersection on 90.7 News. I'm Matthew Petty. How do you create a farm in an urban environment? Up next, we'll talk to an Orlando group that's combining private gardens and pedal power to create a network of mini farms or farmlets. It's called Fleet Farming. Intersection returns in a minute. Welcome back to Intersection on 90.7 News. I'm Matthew Petty. Let's say you want the farm-to-table concept in your own home or from your own backyard, but lack a green thumb. Well, folks like Chris Castro are looking to change that with a concept he calls fleet farming. They turn parcels of people's backyards into so-called farmlets to help grow produce, and their fleet of bicycles picks up the harvest to take it to the market. Well, I'm joined now to talk about the program by fleet farming organiser Chris Castro, who's the executive director of Ideas for Us, which is the non-profit that manages fleet farming. Chris, thanks for coming in.
Thank you for the invite.
And with us in the studio also is Michelle Bumbaya. She's a fleet farm manager. Michelle, thanks for coming in.
Thanks.
And we're joined also by Clayton Lewis Ferrara. He's the executive director of Ideas for Us. Clayton Lewis Ferrara, thank you so much for joining us.
Absolutely.
Well, Chris, let me start with you. Just walk me through this. How does somebody turn their backyard into a farmlet? Or front yard, I should say, right?
Like front yard, side yard, backyard. Traditionally, a lot of people have sent us inquiries via our website, fleetfarming.com. And basically, the interest is that we can come into to somebody's home, completely transform their lawn into an urban farm, and over the course of a season, help to build, maintain, harvest, and even take that produce to market.
Mm-hmm. Where did you get the idea from?
Well, this actually dates back to December of 2013, and John Reif, one of the co-founders of East End Market, and Heather Grove as well, another co-founder, essentially presented this idea to a monthly workshop that Ideas for Us hosts, and it's called The Hive. Mm-hmm. And we were there talking about the challenge of land access within cities and how oftentimes land is very expensive and sometimes it's just unattainable. But we did look around and there's so much unavailable land, underutilized land within our neighborhoods. Mm-hmm. And so the concept arose from The Hive of why don't we figure out a way to partner with homeowners and use their lawn to grow food, activate the community to help maintain it, and then share some of the produce with the homeowner as a repayment, where the rest of it actually gets distributed to local markets and also restaurants.
So how many people do you have on the farmlet program or the Fleet Farm program so far?
Currently, we have 11 in-ground farmlets that are up and running, mm-hmm. and we're looking to scale to a total of 15 by the end of this year. And, you know, over the past year and a half, really, this has grown from a very small pilot of 5 homes to 10 homes this past season, and now we're really expanding to 15.
Mm-hmm. So, Michelle Bumbaya, Fleet Farm Manager, walk me through how this works. So, what do you do day to day? Are you involved in kind of coaching people on how to maintain their property, or how does this all work?
So, a typical day for me would be weeding, seeding, checking up on all of the crops that we have. We grow salad green mixes. So I typically will go through, weed the rows and all of the beds. And if the homeowner wants to come out and speak to me, I'm more than happy to show them the ropes and show them what we got going on. And today I led a group of volunteers and I talked about Fleet Farming at East End Market. Then we went to the Audubon Covenant Church. And we have one of our biggest farmlets there, so we got to harvest together. So that's another part of my job is the harvesting, the seeding, the weeding, the mulching, the composting, all the dirty work.
Well, let me walk back to, so when a homeowner says, yeah, I want to be part of this, you guys would build the plots as well?
Well, typically we test the soil pH to make sure that there's no chemicals on the soil, and they cannot have used chemicals in the past 2 years. So we really want to, you know, honor that and make sure that the land is free of chemicals. So we'll test that. And then if everything turns out good, then we will solarize the plot and put a big sheet of black plastic.
Okay, so solarize, what does that mean?
So you're putting down a big piece of plastic and you're smothering the grass because grass is very invasive, very vigorous, aggressive grower, so you kind of want to kill the grass.
Is it grass or weeds?
Well,
or both?
Both, but a lot of weeds are edible and people don't know that. But you do want to kill, you don't want that in a farmlet. So we solarize the plot with really thick black plastic, and that'll typically be there for 3 weeks, 2-3 weeks. Sometimes a month, it really depends on the grass. We have one farmlet that's had to keep that on for more, 3 or 4 weeks.
Tough grass.
Yeah, it really depends on the what they have growing there already. So after we're done solarizing, we take that off and we till it. Mm-hmm. And that's really fun, building your arm muscles. So we till it, and then we build up the rows, and typically they will have 3 or 4 to 8 rows, more or less. And the Audubon Covenant Church has a lot of rows. That's our biggest one.
19 total.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's really beautiful. But typically they're around like 6 to 8 rows. So then after we build up the rows and we make sure that the aisles are clear of weeds, we will put compost on the top, and we get compost from Monterey Mushroom Farm in Zellwood, Florida. And it's really rich, delicious. It smells really good. So we'll put we'll put that on top and let it sit, you know, let it get happy. And then we will install irrigation. It's on a self timer. And it's a drip irrigation system, so it's no fuss for the homeowner. And they don't really have to worry about it because it's on a consistent timer. And then we will seed. And that's the fun part.
So it's basically you're the gardener for all these.
Mm-hmm.
Do you occasionally get volunteers to help you out?
Yeah, we're a volunteer based project, mm-hmm. so we love having volunteers come out, and the volunteers have so much fun because they learn, and just as much as they're learning from me, I'm learning from them.
Mm-hmm.
One of the coolest parts about this initiative is it really is activating communities to get more engaged, not only in the outdoors, but also where their food is coming from. And a lot of people don't realize that we are transporting our food over 1,500 miles per person, per plate, per day. And when you start to look at the amount of carbon and fossil fuels that are entrenched in industrial agriculture, it's mind-boggling, mm-hmm. honestly. Some say it can contribute up to a third of what we call global climate change around the world. And so we feel that a micro urban farming program within neighborhoods that can scale, not only in Orlando but around the country, is one of those solutions that can get people back engaged with healthy, whole, and organic foods.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Clayton Lewis-Ferrara, let me turn to you now. So you're the executive director of Ideas for Us, and Chris was talking about kind of scaling up the urban farming project. How do you get that concept across to people who haven't seen it, haven't done it? How do you kind of sell this idea?
Yeah, I mean, getting people involved with farming is tremendous, and it can help so many different communities around the world. So we communicate through social media for people to learn about fleet farming. We communicate with many of our chapters that are out there. We've also made films about this as well, and that plays a really huge role in these kinds of things and communicating how to do it, why it's so important, and how it can really help these communities that are struggling with food security.
Mm-hmm. And the cycling, how important is the bicycle in all of this?
Well, it's fun. And I think that things being fun is so important in the environmental movement. It builds community. It gives people a chance to meet people in their community. And not too many of those things exist nowadays. So that's another feature that this brings to the table. Bicycles are great because, of course, they're carbon neutral. Mm-hmm. In fact, you're burning calories. You're not burning energy calories as far as oil and things like that go from the gasoline in your car. So it cuts down on emissions. It gets a car off the road. And it instills a source of community. So it's a really big part of fleet farming and the management of it.
And as you build this out to include more communities, more gardens, is cycling still going to be a viable way of getting around to those places and bringing the produce back to wherever you need to get it to go?
Yeah, I mean, that's what makes fleet farming different than just a urban garden program, you know, where people can walk to the garden or commute there. By having the bicycles, that's what really makes it fleet. And it gives people who are already involved with a lot of bicycle-based programs around the world and just love cycling to now bring it to a level where they're helping to deconstruct the industrial food system, mm-hmm. and to make agriculture less centralized, which, as Chris mentioned, is a huge part of climate change and mm-hmm. something that can really add to the sustainability of a community. Local food's a big part of that.
Right. Michelle Bumbai, let me come back to you. So as far as, you know, from the point of view of somebody who's out there riding around, digging these gardens,
mm-hmm.
Just tell me about the cycling part of it. Do you get the sense that cycling is a good way to go here?
Or? Oh, yeah. Having the community come out on bikes, it's so cool. And when I went to the first swarm ride and I saw the large group that was behind me, it was like, wow, this is real. This is a movement. And while you're cycling, the community sees you. There's people on their cars, and I like to yell at people nice things, and I'm like, hey, fleet farming, yeah. Mm-hmm. So we like to tell people as we're cycling, you know, we like to give little plugs for fleet farming. And a lot of times people will come and ask me what I'm doing. They'll see me on the bike or they'll see me in the farmlet, and they're like, what do you got going on over here? Tell me about this. So it's a really good way to get the community involved by saying, hey, be active, be healthy, come out on your bicycle and come fleet farm.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted to add really quickly, we've been working with Juice Bike Share as well. And the beautiful part about this is we're seeing some people in the community who don't have access to bikes use the Bike Share program, come out and meet us at East End Market when we have our swarm rides, and utilize this infrastructure that we've set up in order to join the local food movement. So that's also a really creative way in which we're creating partnerships.
There's a limit to the amount of your front yard, for example, you can turn over to a garden, though, right?
That is correct. There is. In the city of Orlando, we have an ordinance that allows for 60% of your front lawn to be used as edible landscape. And we certainly fall within that code for each one of the front yard gardens that we install. Mm-hmm. Side yards and backyards have less restrictions. And so we try our best to work within the parameters that the city has set up. But because the city of Orlando has been so progressive with local food systems, it's allowed for innovative programs like fleet farming to flourish and to really get going.
Chris Castro, what about fruit trees? A lot of people have fruit trees on their properties. They might have bought a house which has established, I don't know, mango trees or something, and they're not sure what to do with them. Do you help with that as well?
Of course, and the great question. You know, food waste in general is a huge challenge within this country, and there's about 40% of the food that's currently grown that actually doesn't ever get eaten or consumed. And so what we're trying to do through fleet farming is we've sprouted this new initiative, Fleet Fruits, where homeowners, instead of donating a portion of their lawn, can actually register their tree for a gleaning program. And while we're going around the neighborhood to maintain these farmlets, we can also glean some of the excess fruit and, of course, give some of those to the homeowners, but also take those to market. Skybird Juicers is one of the places that uses these fruits and has used them in the past. And this is a program that really was made possible because of the Healthy Central Florida initiative by the Winter Park Health Foundation.
Mm-hmm. People are often surprised by how many fruits their fruit trees actually drop. Mm-hmm. And instead of letting them rot on the ground, this is just a fantastic alternative that actually gets them into people's mouths.
Mm-hmm. Are you picking fruit while you're out gardening as well, Michelle?
I have picked some fruit, and it's been a lot of fun because a lot of them go to waste, and that attracts pests, rats, mm-hmm. you know, rodents. So it's a really good way to put that fruit back into the community. And I mean, it's good for compost, but it's also better to eat.
Right. Chris, so in this model, basically no money changes hands between the landowner and you folks, but is
Correct.
There any kind of money involved here, like a people paying you for the produce you're giving them, or how does that work?
Sure. So the homeowner, because they're providing their lawn, actually gets about 10% of what we grow mm-hmm. To them, and they can come out and actually get that whenever they'd like. The rest actually gets sent to both local farmers markets, where we sell direct to consumers, mm-hmm. and we also sell to different local restaurants in Orlando through Local Roots distribution.
Right.
And so, yes, we are selling this produce. The funding actually comes back into the 501c3 fleet farming mm-hmm. so that we're able to further grow this initiative to more homes and allow us to, as an example, bring on new staff members like Michelle. Mm-hmm. We were happy to be one of the only organizations in history of Orlando to hire an urban farmer. And we're happy that this is not only a great environmental initiative or community development initiative, but it's also showing that it also has economic development and job creation opportunities for us as well.
Mm-hmm. I mean, one of the hallmarks of a sustainable city is its access to local food. And other cities around the world, if they want to transition to hitting sustainable goals like the city of Orlando is, they have to have some kind of element of empowering people to grow food and not lawns. I mean, the number one agricultural crop that we have here is St. Augustine grass.
Right.
And changing that's a big part of becoming more sustainable.
Michelle, just coming back to something you mentioned before, you talked about a swarm of bikes. Mm-hmm. What is that?
So a swarm, kind of like a swarm of bees, we have a swarm of bikes. Mm-hmm. And every other Sunday of the month, we have our community swarm rides, and we all meet at East End Market, usually at 9, but later on in the year, it'll be around 2. Mm-hmm. And so the community all comes out on their bikes. We do a little bit of weeding at East End or whatever we need to do at the East End plot. And then we'll ride around in the community. And the cool thing about fleet farming is that all of the plots are no more than 2 miles away from each other.
Right.
At the most. So we can really hit most of the plots if we need to. Mm-hmm. So you see us on this big swarm ride.
As this project expands, are there going to be other urban gardeners like yourself joining the team?
Oh, definitely. And especially if we expand to what we're thinking, it would be best in our best interest to have more farm managers that can kind of handle all of these farmlets that we're hopefully going to mm-hmm. get.
Is it, but say, okay, so say you had fleet farming in, I don't know, Apopka or you know, somewhere a little more flying. Is the bicycle still going to be the conduit?
Well,
for...
that would have to be a different program. Mm-hmm. So it's very local based. So right now we're in Winter Park area. So if somebody wanted to open up fleet farming in Apopka, they could purchase our toolkit. It's on fleetfarming.com. It has all the resources you could ever need to start a pilot program for your area. And you would have a pilot program for about 6 months and see how it works out for you, see who's going to run this. And so we wouldn't necessarily be out there, but there would be a new fleet farming team for that specific area.
We're actually seeing that fleet farming has already expanded to the city of Oakland, California, where they have five of their own plots. And they've purchased the toolkit, and we've been consulting with them on how to replicate that to Oakland. We're also speaking, toolkits have been purchased in St. Augustine, West Palm Beach, Miami, and Kampala, Uganda, where Ideas has a huge presence within the African continent. And we're working there to expand this program in their communities as well. Mm-hmm. So we see this as something that's piloted and started here in Orlando, but very much could be a global solution to reducing the impact that the food system has on the environment and to begin driving more locally grown organic produce for people to eat.
Does it work in a place where there's maybe not, you know, good ways to get around by bike or people don't use bikes to commute?
Well, we like to call fleet farming a bike-powered urban farming program, but I think that it could be adaptable depending on the situation or the community that it is in. The real concept is using growing food, not lawns, right? Using underutilized public and private land to grow urban farming, activate the community to help maintain that, and really bring that produce to market.
Mm-hmm. And certainly there's a place for other farming technologies. Doing a farm just in the ground outside of someone's home or on the side of it isn't the only way to do this.
Right.
So many other solutions that we have for people around the world might be an aquaponics system. It might be taking waste from their community like plastic bottles or cans and things like that and turning those into containers for gardening, even especially if you're in an area where there is really arid soils and no easy way to irrigate. By doing a project like that, they're still able to grow food in an urban setting and around their homes, but not do it with in the ground garden.
Mm-hmm. Chris, fleet farming sounds like it's picking up across the country. What else have you got on the boiler?
Here in Central Florida, we have a lot of things going on. We're working on a project with United Global Outreach out in Bithalo. We've been working there for the past year to essentially help to bring solar power as well as a full energy retrofit for a K-12 Orange County Academy as well as a community center there. We've currently got a huge donation from Sun Edison where they're providing 25 kilowatts of solar power to the facility, and we're in the process of engaging UCF students, Valencia students, even students at Rollins College to come out and help revitalize a community that's really in need. So we have that going. We also have our ongoing program, The Hive Orlando, which is a workshop for sustainability every first Wednesday of the month where people of all ages and all disciplines can come together and really develop these solutions that we're taking action on. So those are a couple of different things you can join us on.
So you could hear something like another fleet farming idea or an idea like that coming out of one of these Hive meetings.
Absolutely. And that's the idea. This kind of intergenerational, interdisciplinary exchange of ideas is pretty rare. You know, having someone who's maybe in their 60s or 70s at a meeting talking to someone in high school isn't very common unless they're related to that person. So this gives a realm for this kind of dialogue to go on about solutions and brainstorming that you wouldn't normally have, especially not in an academic setting.
We've been talking about fleet farming. We've been talking to Clayton Lewis Ferrara, Chris Castro, and Michelle Bumbar. Thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you so much.
Support for Intersection comes from our listeners and from Florida Hospital. Intersection's producer is Brendan Byrne. The executive producer is Catherine Welch. To see photographs from the show, including the Thomason Family Farm, visit our website www.wmfe.org/program/intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. Thanks for listening.